Extra, extra, Dawn of Mantis now has a merch store. There are t-shirts, long and short sleeve, as well as hoodies. Just go to dawnofmantis.com and click the t-shirt link.
One day, a while back, roughly 3 years ago, there sat two gingers named Ivan and Joe, when this pair, who had been friends for quite a long time, had an idea pop into their minds. Since they were always sitting and talking a spell, they figured one day they may just as well record themselves talk as the hours would pass and release these gap sessions as a variety podcast. In hopes that some folks around the states and the nations would find entertaining some of these conversations. For 2.5 years, they dad-joked and tea-kettled and remained quite convinced their dynamic was settled. Until one day Ivan exclaimed, "Joe, come here! The sound guy we know, with the fiery beard?" "Yes," Joe replied, "Redbeard Sound Studio." Ivan finished his thought. "He should join us, you know." "Tally-ho," they exclaimed, as they high-fived their hands. And that's how they gained their third ginger, Sam. With their third partner found, their trifecta complete, these friends grace the studio week after week to talk about basically whatever they want, like specters and ghosts and the houses they haunt, and about disappearances and mysterious deaths, tantalizing tales that makes one hold their breath. Murder, true crime, innocent blood spilled, serial killers and the victims they killed. We hope you enjoy all these yarns that they spin, perhaps even enough to listen again. Now enough of this origin story, my friends. Turn up those car stereos, get those earbuds in. Let's finally get to the topic at last and start this episode of Dawn of Mantis podcast.
Quiet your mind.
Ever since the Earth has circled the sun, there have been fantastic tales of wonder and mystery that the faint of heart dare not discuss. But
three
brave, uninformed souls have the brass to tackle every extraordinary happenstance from the modern age to the dawn of Mantis.
Welcome to Dawn of Mantis. We have a special episode tonight. Joe, how are you tonight?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. Sam?
I'm good.
All right. I told
Why was that funny? Why are you laughing?
Because he's getting right into
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I told you. It's going to be a short intro. I was thinking that people are probably hating the long intros. So okay. What if they are? What if one guy is and he's like, "That's the last time I listen." It's like, "Wait, okay, I'm giving you what you want." Even though I don't know you exist, I think you probably do.
Yeah, and plus we got good content tonight.
We do
usually, I hope, most nights, but tonight we're excited.
Could you introduce our guest?
In studio, my friend and yours, I can genuinely say the nicest guy I know.
Yeah.
Oh, and thanks, dude.
Seriously, one of the most talented guys I know also, Scott Screamin' Seaman is in the studio with
All
us.
All right.
Yes. I swear I've heard someone call you that before.
Chuck calls me that sometimes.
That's where I heard it. Yeah. Okay.
Chuck and James.
You might hate it for all I know.
All good, man. All good. I've been called a lot of other things. I can assure you.
That's the best of everything, so that's good. Yeah. So, Scott, you have a lot to talk about, and I can't wait to, you know, how should we preface this? Should we just, how do we start this episode?
Yeah, I didn't give you a very good introduction. Scott is a friend of ours. He's an amazing guitarist, an amazing vocalist. He plays in a badass band named 90 Pound Wrench that we've had the privilege of playing on stage with before. They play all over the entire region. You guys have a ton of original music. Do you have an original album out, don't
we
you?
We do. We have a 14-track album out.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how do people find that?
Right now, Reverb Nation.
Okay.
Working on a new website.
Okay.
Hopefully that'll be out in a couple of weeks, and we'll have the whole catalog on there. I've actually got it set for free download on Reverb Nation right now. So
90 Pound Wrench.
Feel free to grab it.
The number 90 in Pound Wrench, right?
Is 90 LB Wrench.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, there it is. So we plugged you right away. Started off from
appreciate
the beginning.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, no, we okay. want to share cool stuff with
it's
people.
Too bad
for
it's
sure.
free downloads. I'd cut you guys in on that massive streaming profit.
It's okay. We're waiting on a Canada Dry sponsorship. So that's going to happen any day now. We've only been working on that for like 2 years, I think.
Sure it is. Yeah.
It's going to happen.
Yeah.
Come on, guys. It's going to happen.
I don't think it's going to happen.
No, no.
So, man, you're like, it's like having James in the studio. You are just, you know so much about so much, and you do so much. It's kind of like this could be a whole episode about music. It could be a whole episode about paranormal stuff. It could be a whole episode about science stuff. So it's kind of like, I don't know, man. What do you feel like talking about?
Take your pick, man.
I was
take
thinking it's too close to Halloween,
right?
Paranormal.
Oh, yeah. What, okay.
Is what
shoot,
I
yeah.
was kind of hoping for that.
Excellent.
If that's cool.
I made sure I had the pictures ready to show you guys.
Picture.
Yes.
All of it. So,
yes.
You betcha.
So, where do we begin?
Do you want to just begin with the story?
Sure.
Let's do that.
Sure. One Saturday afternoon, my wife was working and my oldest daughter was gone. So, I grabbed my youngest daughter, who is going to be 18, the 18th. No, the 21st. Good night.
But I'll edit anyway, that.
Editing. Yeah, we're good. Serious.
No, just leave it and I'll make her listen to it.
Yeah.
Make her feel really special. Thanks, Dad.
My 18
appreciate
threw
that.
You off. Yeah. It was too perfect.
Yes.
We gotcha.
Actually, my oldest son, his birthday is the 18th.
There we go.
So, yeah.
There you go.
You know, when she turns 21 on the 21st, you're there.
I'm ready. I'm ready.
He might say the 18th then. It's like, oh no, I did it again.
So we were bored one Saturday and I just got her up and I said, hey, let's drive to Eureka and go see if we can find some ghosts in the Crescent.
Love Eureka.
It's a great start to a day.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. But I had been to the Crescent, man, I don't know how many times. And we did the whole Candyman thing and everything that you could think of and never saw anything. And some of it was back before cell phones and that kind of stuff. So we didn't have any way to document it.
Yeah.
But I never saw anything. You know, I always just thought, it's a fluke.
Yeah.
You know, now one night my wife and I stayed at the Basin Park Hotel and some weird stuff went down.
See, that place almost gives me more creeps than the Crescent for some reason.
It's very creepy. The rooms are super small.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife smoked at the time. And so you would walk down this little narrow hall and pop out on this little balcony that was big enough for one person. And she would stand out there. Well, I walked out with her and I left the door to the room open because it was right around the corner. And we come walking down the hall and all of a sudden you hear this bang, bang, bang. What the heck? So we walk into the room and everything of ours that we had set up on the dresser, all the deodorant and all that stuff, was laying in the floor. All the stuff that was there when we got there was still on the desk.
Check, please.
So I'm getting goosebumps right now thinking about
God.
It. And throughout the night, we would just hear things and you just get this feeling. I didn't sleep for the crap.
Right.
Night,
yeah, I'm surprised you stayed.
Yeah. We woke up the next morning. It was like, hey, all right, packed.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah.
Just leave that. Just leave that. We're gone. So anyway, my daughter Madeline and I went to the Crescent.
That's where Joe and I got married to women, not to each other. And not the same day. Not the same day.
Nice. The secret's out.
Yeah.
Nice.
The Crescent?
That's not legal. That wasn't legal in Arkansas then. So
how funny. How funny. Well, you know what? I'm going to go back just a little bit and kind of preface this whole thing. Because I really think Maddie is some kind of a conduit.
You had told me. Yeah.
Because one of the houses that we lived in, she kept telling me, Dad, every once in a while, I see a lady walking down the hall. And I'm like, you're nuts. No way. No freaking way. So I'm laying on the bed in the master bedroom, and the door opens up into this hallway. And I just got this weird feeling, and I look through the door, and I see a woman dressed like she was on Little House on the Prairie. Walking down the hallway.
Oh my God.
God, I'm getting goosebumps again. I mean, it just freaked me out. And I just, you know, I talked to Melissa about it and I my wife, and I said, man, I saw something really weird and I don't know what to think about it. And she said, oh, I've seen it. She said, Maddie told me she sees it all the time. I've seen it.
Oh, she had too.
Yeah.
So everyone in the house.
Yes.
Oh
all
my
of
God.
Us. So then we move to another house And Maddie starts talking about, I keep seeing this little boy in the corner.
Oh, man.
And I'm just like, I believe her because I saw the one at the other house.
For some
reason,
a little boy, I would almost rather her would say, like, I saw a 7 foot tall bearded man smoking a cigar. That's less scary than a little boy.
Absolutely. Creepy. wait till you hear there's a little boy in the Crescent story. So anyway, she keeps talking about seeing this little boy. And I hadn't seen anything until one night, and I came in late. I'd been fishing. And I came in, and I opened the door, and I started to walk into the kitchen. The kitchen was to the left. The hallway to the master bedroom was to the right, which is the corner that she always saw the little boy in. And I got this weird feeling. I look over, and there's a freaking little kid sitting in the corner.
Dude.
And I freaked. So I walked into the kitchen, and I set my stuff down, and I'm thinking, man, I got to walk into the master bedroom and get a shower, go to bed, see if my wife's seen this. And there's this little kid sitting in the corner. And he wasn't looking at me. He was looking toward the master bedroom door. And he was just sitting kind of with his knees up against his chest.
Dude, oh, my God.
Yeah.
So anyway, that freaked me out. So I really think Maddie, for some reason, has this... Like I said, I think she's some kind of a conduit.
I think there are certain people that are more open to it or more, it almost like draws it out or.
Yeah.
Do you ever think about moving away and not taking her or just like.
Tell her sorry.
You stay behind with all your friends.
I'm glad you didn't bring her to help tell the story.
Oh, no kidding. There'd be a little kid sitting back behind you.
I'm sure she's
behind
awesome.
The couch.
I'm joking. I'm sure she's awesome. But I'm just.
I don't. She's really into horror flicks and stuff anyway.
Oh, okay.
And so that morning we get up and we go to the Crescent. And I told her, I said, okay, I'm going to have my phone. You have your phone. Take pictures of everything that you think. You know, every mirror that you see, especially take pictures of the mirrors. And so we're walking up. I don't remember the third floor, I think, is supposed to be the one that's got that super haunted room in it.
Yeah, like 343 or something.
Yeah, something like that. Whatever, so she wanted to go up to there. Well, so we're going up the stairs and she said, quit playing with my hair. And I'm literally like 10 feet behind her. And I said, turn around. And she saw me down there and she said, I keep feeling you put your hand on my shoulder and brushing my hair off my back.
Wow.
And I'm like, no, no. And I'm watching her go up the stairs and I don't see her hair or anything.
Yeah.
So we take a left and we go down just past that super haunted room. And there's a little hallway that dead ends and there's a room to the left. And then a mirror at the end of it.
At the very end, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we stand back almost to the stairs, so we're a good ways back from it. And I'm standing in front of her. She's back probably 10 feet, 15 feet behind me, and we both are taking pictures of this mirror. And we didn't see anything.
Yeah.
So we got done with that, and we went to, it might have even been that same floor. All the way back to the, I guess it'd be the south side of the building. There's another mirror at the end of a hall down there. And I told her, I said, let's get some pictures here. I said, but turn around and face me. And so I took some pictures with my phone and then I took pictures with her phone. So we walk around the rest of the time. We never really saw anything other than her getting that feeling.
Right.
So I said, well, let's go grab something to eat. We go down to the car. And she starts looking at her pictures and she screams. And I said, what do you got? She said, there's somebody behind me in that picture at the end of the hall. And so I pulled my phone up and I said, well, hang on, let me look. All of my pictures are gone. Every picture that I took in the Crescent Hotel is gone from my phone. Gone.
That's bizarre.
Yes.
As all hell.
Oh, and I took a ton.
Yeah.
I took a ton. So we get to looking at the one picture and there's somebody standing behind her. And I'll show you the pictures because you can see me in the foreground. She's standing here and there's this shape behind her. And it looks like it's got a t-shirt on, but the arms look like bone. And this thing is towering over her. You can see the head, the arms, and everything.
I've seen the picture, and I know what everyone listening might be thinking, like, oh, it's a double exposure. So, okay, if with Scott's permission.
Not on a phone, though. That's like.
Well, not even that, but like it's just a trick sure. of the light mm-hmm. or like. But we'll post this with his permission.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I challenge anybody yeah. to. Anyway, proceed. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Instagram.
So anyway, I'm completely wigging out. And so I looked at her and I said, come on, we're going over to the big Jesus. We're going to get some Jesus on so this doesn't follow us home. Because I'm done.
Maybe that's why he's there.
With this stuff. I'm done with this stuff.
Because you can see him from the crescent. So he's probably like, hey, had enough of that? Come over here.
Come over here.
Exactly. So we get in the car and I drive us over there and we're looking and I said, see, there's the crescent over there and there's Jesus. So
yeah. Yeah.
Hopefully everything's going to be cool. Yeah. Hopefully you left him there. Yeah. So then she starts looking through her pictures again and she said, that looks weird. So I blow up the picture and she's standing facing me in front of this mirror and there's two little legs between her legs with black pants on and a kid's hand and head leaning out beside her looking at me.
Do you think this is the same boy, like spirit as from before?
No.
Okay.
Definitely not. Definitely different.
Okay.
So when we got done, we got home, I emailed the ghost tours and the crescent and I sent him the pictures and I was just like, we were just there and I'm never coming back again. I'm really freaked out, but I think you guys should probably look at this and close the third floor. That's why I said, just close it. What? There's too much shit.
Brick it off,
there.
Be
yeah,
done.
Yeah, just yeah. stop renting rooms there. Somebody's going to die. And
someone has died in there, but that's
yeah.
another.
Oh, anyway, yeah.
Several, yes. But go ahead.
So one of the ghost tour emailed me back, and they said that probably 2 or 3 months before we were there, there was a construction worker that was working on the balcony because that's where the restaurant is and the bar.
Yep, the balcony restaurant.
And somebody bailed off of it accidentally and it killed him.
Yep. That. Mm-hmm.
And they think that was who was standing behind Maddie.
Whoa.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And it like literally 2 or 3 months after the dude died, but they said, we're pretty sure that's who that was.
Well, there's also supposedly a child, a younger, like a boy that died there back.
And that's probably what we saw.
Wasn't his name Adam or something?
I don't remember the name, but it wasn't like way back in like in the 20s or 30s or something.
Probably so, yeah.
He fell or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's what I was referring to about the construction worker when I was saying someone had died there, because that was pretty
right.
recent.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was literally within 2 or 3 months of our trip up there.
God, that's insane.
So it was bizarre. And, you know, they emailed back a couple of times and they never could explain the kid. They didn't say anything about that for some reason. But I tried to convince them to just stop at the second floor and
you know
leave
that,
the rest of it alone, close the restaurant, don't let anybody up there.
Well, that really haunted room, that thing is booked out for like a year in advance.
Yeah.
Everybody yeah. wants to stay there. Now,
idiot. Jeez.
Now, I, like Ivan said, I got married there 14 years ago. Ivan got married there how many years ago?
Mm.
Oh, you're on the spot. Jennifer, are you listening?
Oh.
Tick-tock, still hasn't answered. Someone's on the couch.
Like 17. I don't know, 18, somewhere around there. 19.
I promise I'm not good with numbers like that. And
oh,
she knows
know.
That.
Yeah.
But she still gets mad. So that's the important part.
September 27th, 2008, we got hitched there. And we've been there many, many times before, many, many times after. Nothing had ever happened to us either, except for one time. And I don't remember what floor we were on. It wasn't the first. It was second or third floor. And this is not that scary, but it's something. We, like I always, like every guy does, I took out all my pocket change and I throw it on the nightstand before mm-hmm. we went to bed. And in the middle of the night, I just kept hearing like little pings, like ping, 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 ping. You hear like a little scrape and a little mm-hmm. ping, ping, ping. And then you'd hear a roll and then ping way over there. You guys know where I'm going with this. But I got up and turned the light on and all the change that I'd thrown up there had been raked off. And it wasn't like precariously perched right on the edge. No, I threw yeah. it in the middle of the damn table.
That's crazy. Because
people are like, well, what? Okay, I get it that it's a stretch to believe some stuff, but sometimes someone's explanation is almost harder to believe than what something paranormal. Like, well, what if wind? Okay, I'm like, wind? Yeah. Did Hurricane Ida?
In a hotel room blowing change around.
Yes. like there was this one show that came on a long time ago, and I can't remember the name of it, but this guy would just go around and debunk paranormal stuff. Mm-hmm. It was so half-assed and ridiculous, because there was one where the woman, she was cleaning, and there was a glass, like a beer mug, sitting on her table, and it just burst. So he comes in, he's walking around, and he's like, I see there's a pretty busy highway out the window there. I bet a large truck drove by in the vibration. And I'm like, jeez. The hell did you just say? A truck drove by? I'm sorry, if that was the case, then every pub in New York mm-hmm. would just be going through millions of dollars worth of mugs, because these trucks keep driving by yep. and busting our mugs. So that's what I'm saying, is like, sometimes the explanation is harder to believe than
right.
what we're even asserting. You know
seems
what I mean?
Like most times it's better to just say, I don't know what that could
exactly.
be.
Exactly. If you yeah, don't I mean, know, say you don't know. Don't,
I mean, that's really honesty. You know, yes. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that could have been.
And it's worth mentioning that the show Ghost Hunters, did you see the episode where they went to the Crescent?
I did not.
Dude, I've got it on DVD. I'm sure you can find it on YouTube.
It's mm-hmm. on Discovery Plus.
Okay. At the time, and this has been years ago, but at the time they said it was the most haunted place they'd ever been.
Oh, wow.
They captured a full body apparition down in the basement. Plain as day, nice. Full body. It's like on the thermal camera or something. Mm-hmm. We've got to show you, because it's their crown jewel. It's like one of the greatest things they ever found, that yeah. show. So yeah,
the
yeah.
ghost tourists, I think they still take you down there to where that doctor would do. I mean, he was trying to help people, but he said that the waters from the spring could maybe cure things like tuberculosis.
Cancer
and yeah. 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 So, I mean, when people died, he would like sneak them out and they would say, oh, we sent Jimmy home. You know,
yeah.
it's like, he's wow. all better because of the magic waters. So they think a lot of that, like, you know, energy is like, you know, because he said he could do something that he couldn't, that negative energy of those spirits is still around there. And they take you down where he did a lot of like autopsies, because he was trying to learn like, okay, why did they die? Maybe I could really help them. And he wasn't really a licensed doctor.
Right.
So he's like doing autopsies nice. On him, trying to figure out what killed him. So he could really, I think he was really trying to help people, from what I gather from reading about all that. But when you don't go on a ghost tour, they take you down there and it is yes. very creepy. For sure.
Yep. That building's just got that weird aura.
Yeah.
Every time I've pulled up in that parking lot, I feel it before I mm-hmm. even get out of the car.
Yeah.
You know, and then as soon as you walk in the door, hi, welcome to the Crescent.
yeah.
Whatever. This isn't a happy place.
That Ghost Hunters episode is season 2, episode 13.
That was really early. Wow.
I'll check that out. Is that still on?
I don't know.
I think they still do it.
Oh, really?
Because
mm-hmm. yeah, I don't know.
I might find a way to email them the pictures.
Yeah,
that we got.
Yeah,
because that. Yeah, especially if they got a full body.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
oh, it was amazing.
Yeah,
yeah, it's still going.
You know, most of the stuff that I've seen people take, and even on the website of the Crescent and the Ghost Hunter tours, is orbs. That kind of stuff. Oh, we got an orb. We got an orb.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm the same way. I'm like, okay.
You can explain an orb, you know, a reflection here or whatever, but, you know, if you want to call it a ghost, okay.
Yeah.
That's fine. I had a dude standing behind my daughter. It was not light.
You had a kid playing hide and seek behind your daughter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm a firm believer in that stuff.
That's cool. Yeah.
Very, very big time.
Well, photos on her. So, I talked about this a long time ago on the podcast, but I also, like, I grew up in a house. We were dirt poor, and the house I grew up in was hauled to over this, in this place in Oklahoma, but it was hauled from Summers, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And when it was in Summers, it used to be a church. And so this is what I was told, and my dad told me. My dad might have been messing with me, but it really was a church. And the back room, which was my bedroom, he said that, at the time it was a church, was where they would have funerals. So, in other words, where the casket would be.
Oh, wow.
I've got a dozen witnesses to what I'm about to tell. And I'm going to wrap up 10 years of weird shit in just like a minute. So, yeah, I was an imaginative kid, right? And so I always thought something was going on, freaking out. But I tell you what, stuff always happened back in this room. Swear to God, like, I've seen a glass slide off my desk. I've seen my guitar fall forward, like leaning very far against in a stand, just almost looked like it was karate kicked out, like leap off the thing and fall into the ground. My dog, my little chihuahua, would lay her ears back and growl and look into the corner just randomly.
Wow.
I'm like, what are you, what's there? You know? And she just wouldn't take her eyes off of it. Stuff would happen all the time. My TV would come on by itself. The radio would change stations. I'm telling you, any childhood friend of mine would tell you he's not lying.
Mm-hmm.
The craziest one was, we went to like Chuck E. Cheese. And I got some tickets, and not very many tickets because I suck at everything. And I got this red plastic ring. So it's just like a big plastic ring.
I love the story, by the way.
So and by the way, this house is like 900 square feet, and it was built before electricity. So mm-hmm. when they retrofitted it for electricity, they just ran the wires outside the walls.
Right.
In conduit.
Like through conduit?
Yeah. Wow. It was all outside the walls. The electrical boxes, everything was just nailed to the wall.
Huh.
That's the way the whole house was. It had a tin roof, like a rusty tin roof. You know, mm-hmm. I'm talking, this is an old ass house. So all the light bulbs were just like just a naked little light bulb with a chain that you just pulled. And so that was what was in my room. And so what I did was when I got home, I took this red ring and I took a piece of shoelace and I tied the red ring on the end of the chain so I could pull it easier.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, I don't know. I'm not that 8, 9, 10 or something. Starting that night, I would lay in bed and I would hear like tink, tink, ting, ting. So I'm like, look, and it's that chain hitting the light bulb because the ring, this is swinging back and forth.
Wow.
And I would swear on anything you can swear on for this. And it would do it until it stopped. And then it would do it again, just like a cat was batting it or something. So I'm just like, this is not,
that's crazy.
Right? Yeah.
Wow.
It's not even the best part.
No, I wouldn't sleep in my room for years. We had a little tiny den with a couch, and just on the other side of that wall was my parents. So I would sleep in that den. I didn't sleep in my room for years, mostly because of that. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I would sleep in there. It even got to where my mom, who half believed me, kind of, I think, she even told me, like, I'll give you a quarter a night if you can sleep in the room, you know? And I'd be like, oh man, there's a Hot Wheels are 89 cents, 4 nights. And I would try it, you know? And I would only get a couple of nights.
And some change.
And some change. I'm rich. My mom would go in there and read Bible verses and stuff before I went to bed.
Wow. You know,
because I think eventually she was just like, I don't think he would be messing with me for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved out of that house when I was 21. My dad passed away in 2001 when I was 21. And I got married just a couple months after he died, moved out, got my own place with my new wife. My mom was still in that house. She was there a few more years, maybe 4 or 5 more years. If that long. So anyway, she sells the house. I found out that it was purchased by a guy that I worked with. His brother bought it. And so I told Luke, I was like, look, can we go out to that? I haven't been in that house for years, you know, because they were moving in and doing stuff to it. It's like, let's go out and look at the house. So me and Luke drive out there, and his brother, I was just like, has anything weird happened here, you know, since you guys moved in? And he goes, yeah. Like everything was in that back room, by the way, my mm-hmm. old room. I was in that back room working on something, and I set my screwdriver down for 2 seconds, turned around, and it was gone. And when I found it, it was like in the kitchen on a counter or something, you know? Super weird. But he's like, the weirdest thing was, I was working on my truck outside. When I came in, went to the bathroom, I took my wedding, I think it was wedding ring or made class ring, I can't remember, a ring off, set it on the counter, washed my hands. Kind of forgot the ring was there till later in the day. So it's like, I went back, it was not there. And so he's like freaking out because of this expensive ring. He said, we looked for the ring. I think it was a couple days or something. Shit you not. He said, I found it tied to the end of the string for the light in that back room.
I knew you were going to say that. Oh my God.
Dude, look at me.
Every hair in my body is standing up right now. My braid's about to raise straight up.
And that means you and that ghost are forever connected.
Oh,
how does that make you feel?
Crap.
Sorry. Wait,
dude,
sorry.
I just turned white, you know, and he was just like, what? What did I say? And then I told him the story.
Jeez.
And that's just one of the craziest things, man, that I've ever been a party to.
Yeah. that's insane.
I love that story.
Woo! But yeah, even telling it this many years later, it's just good God.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Wow, no sleep for me tonight.
What about you guys?
The only thing that probably scarred me when I was a kid that was kind of like that is, do you guys remember waterbeds? And Joe, you know this story.
Oh, yes.
And you've got the ledge under it, so mm-hmm. you've got that little, sometimes there's like pull-outs where you can put there's like drawers in there you can put stuff in. So I loved Star Wars when I was a kid. So sometimes I'd sneak in my mom and dad's room and they would even be asleep. And I would play like that was like the trench that they were in with the TIE fighters. And I'd crawl around. I was a weird kid. I would crawl around that trench and I'd pretend like I was like shooting the TIE fighters and stuff. So it's real dark. Crawl around the corner one day or one night late. And it was probably 9 or something. My parents went to bed early. But as soon as I crawled around the corner, I stopped in my tracks because there was a face there. And I know it was probably a trick of light or something, but it was like, it's hard to describe. I've tried to draw it before, but it never does it justice. But it was like an entirely black face, but it had black eyes too. And it was just like staring at me, like just like a foot away. And so I'm sitting there like squinting my eyes, like trying to adjust to see if it's like a trick of light or something. But then the mouth opens.
Oh, boy.
And then it's like that.
Wow.
So I think now that as a rational adult, that might have been one of my parents like snoring or like breathing or something. But it all came together. My brain is like, that's a face that's going to attack me.
Well, that's what I was going to say was, were they always sleeping when you snuck in there?
Because
what if you were like, this ghost was just beating on the bed and I was yelling and...
Somebody was crying for God.
Yeah. There was moaning.
My parents' bedroom was haunted, yo.
I don't know. I don't want to stir up any memories like that.
But poor Ivan.
To end that story, I forgot that I was under the ledge thing, and I tried to lift straight up.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like, nice. And it was like, thump, thump. And I couldn't, like, understand it.
Oh, dude.
Like, there was a bed above me.
Yeah.
And then I jumped out of bed with them and woke them up and started crying and screaming, and they were like, what the heck? But that story sticks with me forever just because it seems so real. Maybe it wasn't. And we didn't really have any like ghosty things in that house because it was like a brand new house. So I don't know. But that story really sticks with me. I always try to tell it.
I got a funny one like that for you. I moved from Bakersfield, California to West Fork, Arkansas.
My God, what a culture shock.
I did not want to be there. I got on the bus with my skateboard, wearing all my Vans clothes and everything, and got off the bus to a dirt road around the school, nowhere to skate, nothing. I hated it. Hated it. Ended up fighting all the people that would be my friends later on, you know, because they didn't like the blonde-haired California surfer skater kid.
Yeah.
So, hey, dude.
By the way, we have to go back and revisit how in the hell you ended up here, but we'll do that later.
Well, one of my best friends, his mom would clean this big house, and rumor had it that the guy that owned it killed his daughters and wife in this house. So they would go over when the people that owned it would go out of town, and they would spend the night over there. And it was a nice house, big house. And it had this room off the back, had a pool table on it, and 3 of the walls were nothing but glass.
Oh, nice.
So you could see all over the place. And then there's a little hedge like that. Well, Eric, my friend, he kept saying that sometimes you would look up the stairs and you would see legs. You would see something walking around up there. So one night, he invited me and another guy over there to spend the night in that house. His family was staying there. So we got the record player in by the pool table, and we're listening to Sam's favorite song. I think it was Don't Stop Believing, to be honest with you.
How ironic.
From a previous conversation.
Pre-show.
So anyway, we're looking up at that hall and talking about what we would do if we saw somebody or saw something up there.
Yeah.
So one of us made the comment, man, I'd pick up one of the pool balls and I'd walk up there and I'd throw it at them. I'd take the pool cue and I'd shove it up their ass or whatever, you know.
Well, sure you would. We got a badass over here. Yeah.
So in the meantime, Eric's dad's sitting in the living room listening to all this stuff. We're playing pool and we're talking about what badasses we are and what we would do to this ghost. And we're all standing on one side of the pool table, and all of a sudden, you just see this face rise up over the top of the hedge that was out there.
Dude.
Eric's dad had gone out there, and he had a flashlight, and he just stuck his head up. So I hit the floor. One of the other guys took off running into the other room. Eric just sat there completely paralyzed. Then we see his dad laughing because he saw what our response was. He came in, he said, "Yeah, a bunch of badasses, son."
I would sit there really still and be paralyzed with fear.
That's exactly what happened.
I'd soil myself. That's how bad I am. That's awesome. He called your bluff.
Yeah. I love it.
And what's funny is, as scared as I was of that house, one of my best friends later on in high school, they moved from San Antonio and they bought that house. And I used to go over there and just drink all kinds of old Milwaukee with him, and we just get hammered and play music, you know? And I never even thought twice about it, you know? But.
Well, dude, it's really quickly a part two to my story about the house where the red ring was. I kind of forgot about this, but I talked about it on another episode. Really quick, whatever that thing was in there didn't like my wife at all. Because when we first got married, I had bought this little tiny house, but I had to, she and I lived with my mom for just a few months until that house was fixed up. I literally bought my first house for $12,000.
Wow.
In 2001. It was a 900 square foot shell, and I just kind of built it out. Anyway, while we were finishing that,
it cost $200,000 today.
No kidding. Let me tell you, I just bought and sold a couple of houses this year. And I can testify to that.
That's the way it is.
But anyway, so whatever that thing was in there, I got home from band practice one night, and it was cold. My wife is sitting out on the porch in a bathrobe, her hair still wet, shivering. My mom, I think, was at church because my wife was the only one there. And I was like, "What the hell happened?" And she said she was taking a shower, and she thought she'd heard a noise in there or something, so she's like, gonna get the shower done quick. She said when she got out and put her robe on, something shoved her. She said, "I felt two hands on my back, full force, shoved me into the door, knocked the door open, and into the hallway."
Wow.
That's the only time I know of that anything was ever actually physically done in that house. But she ran out, and she had been sitting out there like, I don't know how long, you know, before I pulled up. And she was like, "We're moving into the house this week. I don't care if it's done or not."
Holy smokes.
And we were out after that, not too long after
that.
You
should have taken her to the Eureka Jesus.
Yeah.
Because it helped us. We hadn't seen anything since then, so.
2 hours away, we're driving there right now.
Oh, dude, yeah, that's just crazy, man.
I remember one night we were messing with that Ouija board in your house when she lived.
Oh, dude.
Oh, there. I got really into that shit for a little bit.
I'm not kidding.
And when we were done, she was like, "Take that thing and throw it away." And we're like, "Okay." And she's like, "No, drive out somewhere." And so I ended up littering that night. Remember, we had to drive way out. And of course, that gave us an excuse to run into town to get more beer. But but we did. We had to. She said, "That will not come back." Because it said something weird. I can't remember what it said. But
yeah, there was a short period there where I got a Ouija board. I had the Satanic Bible. Like my wife came home from work one day. Not kidding. I was in the bathtub. Bottle of wine, cigar, Satanic Bible, like in a bubble bath, just reading. And she walked in and was like, "We need to change some things."
Yeah.
You know, and that was right around the time that I got really into the Ouija board, got Ivan into it.
Didn't you see the movie Witchboard with Tawny Kitaen?
Sure did.
See what happened there?
I remember them asking when they were going to die. And that's like, you should never ask that question.
Yeah. Well, and then the dude from General Hospital or whatever it was, Patch from Young and the Restless. Don't ask me how I know that. He took the axe to the head. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
You should have known. Yeah. Don't mess with the Ouija board.
Yeah. Well, at one time, Joe bought that book, and you also, every weekend, you'd go and buy a serial killer book or two. And so I remember we had to tell you, we're like, "You're on a watch list, Joe." I mean, if somebody drives by and they're in a suit, you know why.
Yeah.
They're checking.
Man, I'm the same way with the serial killer stuff. My wife and I both. Man, I have watched every documentary on Prime and Netflix and all of them.
That's us.
Of every serial killer known to man. If you killed more than two people, I'm watching your documentary.
So who would you say, I hate to say favorite, but like one that you kind of lean in on more than the others, maybe?
Man, freaking Bundy.
Oh, yeah. God.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
He's number two.
Okay.
Green River Killer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Gary Ridgway.
Yes. I read some fiction books about that, and I kind of got the taste for it, and then I started researching it and stuff. How crazy was that? How long he got away with that stuff?
To tie those two together, I've got a book.
My gosh.
Robert Kepler or somebody wrote a book called Ted Bundy Helps Me Catch the Green River Killer. And they went to Ted for a profile. It's a great book. I'll let you borrow it. It is a phenomenal book.
Man, you talk about Bundy.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Yeah. It's so weird.
He put the cast on and pretended like he was hurt. He needed help loading his bike.
That's
smart, but yeah.
And then when he was at, I think it was Sammamish. I don't know how to pronounce all those weird Washington State words.
Right.
When he was at that lake, he got two girls in one day.
Yes.
He abducted one.
When he was
one,
first starting out.
Yeah, and then went back and got another one.
But he was so charming and so well-educated.
Sure.
That you never, even when he was in court.
Yeah.
You're looking at him going, man, surely it can't be that dude.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, in the woods right up the road, he's got a bunch of them stashed.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That was when he was in Colorado.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know if the profile, did the profile point to somebody like him? Because you wouldn't think that it would. Someone with people skills and
I don't think it pointed.
I think it did. I think they had
smart.
Somebody did a drawing. And I think that kind of gave them the general, this is what this guy looks at. Like, but I don't think they ever had anyone say, yeah, this guy was, he was so charming. You know, I had to go with him. Even the one that got away in the shopping center.
Oh, yeah.
She didn't even talk about that.
Right.
Yeah. You know,
She was able to like fight him off in the car as they were driving out. And,
right.
Yeah. And she jumped out.
Yeah. Wow. But she never said it, or at least not that I have seen. And I've watched, has to be every documentary that, you know, on him in his case.
Yeah.
I don't remember her ever talking about his demeanor or anything like that.
You know, he worked alongside Anne Rice at that suicide hotline.
Right.
Because that's why she wrote Stranger Beside Me. She wrote a book about it. And even she was like, never would have guessed it in a million years.
Yeah.
He walked her to her car at night to keep her quote unquote safe.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy? He probably kept people from killing themselves. So he did.
he could get to him?
Well, are you one of those Hitler had a good idea?
What I'm saying is, if he worked at a suicide hotline place,
no, I know,
and he's playing the part, he had to have helped people too. I'm not saying, you know, I'm not jumping to his camp or anything. I'm just saying,
but serious.
That's very, isn't it ironic?
It really is.
My Alanis Morissette.
Yeah. To me, it's fascinating seeing the different personalities of all the different guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you had a whack job like Dahmer.
Okay.
You know, I mean, good God. And then you got Bundy, who's Mr. Personality. You know, Dahmer, he was always a weirdo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's fascinating to see their background, for one thing.
Yeah.
You know, what led them to the depths of hell that they
sure.
went through
yeah.
to make them what they are.
Yep.
But, you know, how can you be like Ted Bundy and be like that?
Sure.
You know, it's fascinating.
Yeah. You know, I've got, speaking of Dahmer, I've got a typed letter from Dahmer from prison like 6 months before he was killed.
Wow.
I've got a little bit of a murderabilia collection because I've also got the earthquake killer, Herbert Mullen, from the 70s.
Uh-huh.
So he's schizo. And all day long, he just sits and has these index cards and he just writes symbols and phrases and numbers. And it's just nonsensical craziness. But I have one of those.
Wow.
And then I also, he wasn't a serial killer, but the guy, the obsessed fan who killed Rebecca Schaefer off that TV show, Robert Bardo.
Yep.
I've got a drawing of his. He does artwork and drawings. Yeah.
Wow.
So I have that.
So you're celebrating killers.
No.
That's what critics would say. I'm just
some of this stuff I remember from when I was a kid, like the whole Richard Ramirez case.
Oh, dude.
You know, I was out there.
When you were, yeah.
On. I was out there when
Whoa.
That was
Do you
going
remember,
on.
Like, real time?
I remember some of the news. My parents kind of sheltered. My dad was a hellfire and brimstone Church of Christ preacher.
You're kidding
when
me.
For most of my life.
Dude, I had no idea.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Explains the way I am.
That's wild.
But anyway, they kind of sheltered us from that kind of stuff. But I do remember seeing on the news, you know, them talking about it and seeing the panic that was going on because I was north of L.A. You know, Bakersfield's probably hour and a half north of L.A.
Okay.
But, you know, I remember that going on. And I also remember, what was the two dudes? Angelo Bono and...
Oh, the
Hillside Stranglers.
Yeah.
Yes.
Kenneth Bianchi.
Kenneth Bianchi.
Kenneth Bianchi, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so I was out there when that stuff was going on. You know, I was a kid, but I was older during the Richard Ramirez thing.
Yeah.
That one creeps me out.
Yeah,
that dude was twisted.
Yeah. Really, and the things, twisted. I won't even say some of the things he did.
He kind of so evolved before everyone's eyes, right? I mean, he wasn't a killer. I mean, obviously, it's a common tale, but like in the public eye, he evolved from rapist to murderer, right? Is that kind of how that one works out?
He did, yeah, because this part just turns my stomach, but the young girls.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That he would take home and rape and torture and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then drop them off at a phone booth.
That reminds me of Rodney Alcala, too. The dating game killer? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
He did that several times before he started murdering and stuff. But
yeah, crazy. I like how we've evolved into serial killers from ghosts.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all pretty dark tonight, but that's all right.
That stuff's just fascinating.
It is.
It really is.
It fascinates me because people look at me like I'm creepy, but it fascinates me because it's so opposite of anything I could do.
Sure.
Like, the only thing I've ever killed in my whole life is 4 roosters, and we've told that story here. Seriously.
We kind of touched on that last week.
Yeah, and that traumatized me. I'm still traumatized a little bit from killing
those roosters. And somewhere there's a bunch of chickens talking about you. Did you hear the case about Joe Hall?
He's a serial rooster killer.
Hey, it was for a good cause.
Hey, he saved some chickens.
I did.
Yeah, that's true.
The hens praise you.
That's right. Yeah, the roosters, not so much.
But dude, like, I'm the guy that, like, I hit a dog one time when I was a teenager, and I didn't know I'd hit it. Another guy, a friend of mine was driving behind me, and I was just cruising down the back roads like we did all the time. Back roads where, like, the grass has grown inside where it's almost like whipping at your fenders.
Sure.
And when we got home, he was like, "You clobbered that dog." And I was like, "Where? What? When?" So I guess a golden retriever or something had started to come out, and he saw like my bumper just right in its head, and it just fell down. I didn't know. I drove back out there that night like bawling, and I saw it there, and I was just like, "I'm so sorry, throw up," you know, like that's me. So
what if he hit it and pinned it on you?
Oh, what an evil bastard!
You never thought about that.
That's what I'm going to decide happened.
We hit a huge dog coming back from the lake one night, and it ran at the truck and didn't see the boat and trailer, so got it with the trailer. But we locked it up and jumped out, and that dog got up and ran off like nothing was wrong. We're just like, holy crap. We'd fished all night, and so we're punch drunk anyway. We get back to the house, and I walk back, and it had knocked the spare up a little bit. And then on the tire, there was a ring of hair in the rim. And that dog had shit on the step right behind the fender that you step up on to get on the boat. There was a big pile of dog shit.
Knock the shit out of him.
Yes. And we're punch drunk anyway, so we're rolling. I actually have pictures of that somewhere.
We'll put that on Instagram.
Hopefully he was okay. Hopefully he was okay.
Yes.
No dogs were actually harmed.
a little harmed, but just,
you know, a little less hair and a little less shit than before he met the trailer.
Yeah, yeah. But live to bark another day.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Dawn of Mantis is brought to you by Redbeard Sound. Redbeard Sound provides music production, audio editing, and live sound engineering, and is where Dawn of Mantis records our podcast. You can find Sam's information on our website, dawnofmantis.com, or at redbeardsound.com.
I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on the whole satanic Bible thing, because when I was growing up, like I said, I was a hellfire and brimstone Church of Christ preacher's son. I actually studied religions.
Really?
Yes. And I had different books, you know, that it was something of man versus the word of God. And you just see how, in my opinion, all these different religions tailored themselves to fit their lifestyles.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I bailed off the deep end and started looking at Satanism and stuff like that, just studying it, you know. But I went through the whole black metal thing and the church burnings in the 90s over in Norway, you know, where they were burning those old stave churches that were built in the 1400s.
God.
And I kind of went off the deep end a little bit in that, in some research, and I'd like to sit down and talk to you sometime and hear you know, what you got out of it.
You probably know a lot more than me, but it was just something. I was the same thing as you. My parents, neither of them were preachers, but they were pretty, if the church doors were open, I was there.
Sure.
Sunday morning and, you know, afternoon, and then Wednesday night, and then, God forbid, if there was a revival, I was there every night. Right. And so my parents, they were, you know, they were my adopted parents. And so when they adopted me, I was 4 years old. And I think my dad was 62 and mom was like 56. So they're up there when I was 4 years old. When I turned 16 and got my license, they was like, that's when they stopped making me go. They said, you can drive to church or, you know, you don't have to go anymore. I think I drove a couple more times after that, but I never hated it, but I was just other stuff I'd rather be doing.
Sure.
But then I was same as you. I got into kind of like, I want to know about all these other religions though.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out there were older religions and different religions, and, you know, Buddhism is, that's not really a religion, but, you know, I was like, mm-hmm. It's really cool. And yeah, so Satanism was another one that's like, well, it's there. So yeah, I
might
read
as
about
well
it.
Check it out.
Yeah. I'm not scared.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was, I read through the Satanic Bible once and I kind of got out of it like, you know, that's the whole thing. Like do whatever makes you happy.
Exactly. I actually knew some people that belonged to the Church of Satan. And one night over beers, many beers, I finally got the balls up to say, you know, what's your deal?
Yeah.
Tell me what's your motto here?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, do you have a catchphrase?
Yeah.
What do you got going on here? And it basically was, I'm just going to do my thing.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to live for me.
Yeah.
I'm going to make myself happy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying I'm going out there drinking blood and, you know, killing people and that kind of stuff, but a lot of stuff about the earth.
Yep.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. A lot of people confuse Wicca with something more satanic, but Wicca, I think, is just straight like all about the earth and earth energy.
Right.
But isn't like Satanists really, they don't even really believe in Satan, do they?
Not so necessarily.
That's
It's really weird. And it what gets me is Satanism in America is, you know, and you can go look at the whole Anton LaVey thing and all that stuff. It's all pretty much, hey, I'm here. I'm just here to party.
Yeah.
I'm here to have a good time, and I'm going to take care of myself.
Yeah.
And I'm my own God and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Well, you get over to the Scandinavian countries, and Satanism takes on the horror movie aspect of it.
Really?
Yeah. So when you delve into the black metal scene that was there in the 90s, you know, it was all about, those guys were going out and killing homosexuals and, all kinds of stuff. And then, like I said, you know, they felt like Christianity was forced on them. So they went out and burned all these ornate stave churches that were built in the 1400s that were just a fascinating piece of architecture.
Sure, beautiful,
you know,
stuff
that have been there forever. So you got a bunch of guys in long hair and white corpse paint makeup that are playing music that absolutely sucks balls. It's horrible, you know.
There's an honest review.
Yeah.
Well, I did a lot of research on this, and I've actually got a bunch of books on the black metal guys, you know. And Alice Cooper, I watched a documentary, and Alice Cooper was talking about, every time I go over here and tour the Scandinavian countries, I'll come into Norway, and these guys all show up in their corpse paint and their spikes and carrying their axe and whatever weapons it is. He said, and they want to be all tough, but they'll come backstage at the show and say, Mr. Cooper, could I have your autograph for my mother? Yeah, so some of them, there's a big front.
Yeah.
You know, the music scene from that, it started with bands like Bathory and Venom. Of course, they're the ones that named the genre. They put out the album Black Metal.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so they're singing about Satan, you know. And with them, it was shock value, kind of like Kiss. You know,
sure.
It was pure shock value.
Right.
Well, then you started getting a bunch of these kids coming out, and they're like full on, hey, I'm going to be the exorcist.
Yeah.
You know,
it's not shock value to them. It's life.
No, to them, it was, you know, I'm going to prove I'm the most evil guy. And what brought it crashing down, besides the guys getting busted for burning the churches, was there was one guy, Varg Vikernes, that was in one band, Burzum. And then there was this guy, he called himself Euronymous. And he owned a record store, and it was called Hell. And they would meet down in this black room downstairs from the record store. Well, Euronymous was kind of the instigator. You know, somebody would go out and kill somebody, and he would say, yeah, I told them to do that. So Varg dude thinks, well, that son of a bitch thinks he's more evil than me. I don't think so.
Uh-oh. We have an evil off.
He goes up. Yeah, exactly. So he shows up at his apartment and kills him.
No.
Stabs him like 80-something times. Oh, I mean, it was just, God. It was ridiculous.
Wow.
And that kind of brought that whole scene just, it was gone.
Yeah. People are like, okay, this is getting a little out of hand.
Yeah. And now you've got, you know, there's so many genres of it. You got symphonic black metal. You've got pure black metal. And like the pure black metal, their goal is to make their album as lo-fi as it can possibly be.
Really?
And when we get done, I'll pull up some of those bands and let you hear some of it. They would literally take these little PV amps, tiny, 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 and throw distortion pedals in front of them. And they wouldn't even close mic them. They'd room mic it. So the guitar just kind of sounds like...
Oh, my gosh.
It's horrible. And they're playing. It's all... Tremolo pick.
Yeah.
Wait, that's what I was doing when I was 14 until I started figuring out how things should sound.
But I mean, there's a movie, and I can't remember the name of it. I've got a book that chronicles that whole scene, but that band, Mayhem, they were kind of the big on the front end. That was where that Euronymous guy, that was his band. Well, they got a singer from Sweden. His name was Dead. That's what he called himself. And every time they would go in the house, they would smell something, and he would bring dead animals and stuff into the bedroom. And he was fascinated with suicide and death and stuff.
I think I know where you're going with this.
So they come back to the house, and dude took a shotgun, blew his head off. So the picture of him laying on the bed with the shotgun next to him was
their album cover. Yes, I've seen it.
And then rumor had it that before Euronymous made any phone calls, he took pieces of the skull fragments and made necklaces for the rest of the guys in the band.
Oh,
and
then
put some of the brains in stew and ate it. And I mean, there's all kinds of folklore about it, you know.
That picture, I wouldn't recommend looking at it, but the picture he's talking about, that album cover, I accidentally found it one time. And I don't even remember how, but it was a Google image search. And I was just like, I was like going on in this picture, and I looked, and it was like the true story behind this gruesome album cover.
Yeah.
And then it was dude, they used his picture. And
absolutely.
It is just like watermelon split open head right there. It's crazy. Yeah.
And I mean, sadly, there's something kind of sweet about that, because they knew he would have wanted them to use that. You kind of smell what I'm saying. I'm not trying to be the Rock or something. That's just what it's thought of to say. But that's what he would have wanted to say.
It's like when they didn't embalm Gigi Allen. They just threw him in a casket and was pouring liquor on him. And, you know, it's like, that's what he would have wanted, that crazy bastard.
Well, you know, it all goes back to what I was talking about. Everybody wanted to be more evil than the next guy.
Yeah.
You know, and there was this one guy. I don't even remember what band he was in. They called himself Gall. And
Gall of them.
Have you seen, there's a like a 5-part documentary called, it's something about metal, but it's basically the history of metal. And this guy that's actually an anthropologist breaks down all the genres, and he does a documentary on all this stuff. So he goes over to Norway and finds Gall. And this guy walks him up the mountain in the snow to show him this cabin. Well, then they pan back, and he's sitting in this dark room, and he's got this giant goblet full of red wine is what it looked like. Sam Dunn was the videographer's name. And he would ask him a question. Well, you know, why do you think the churches should be burned? And every answer was, Satan. That's all he would say. And he said it like 25 or 30 times.
Oh, my God.
Satan. Well, this guy was talking about, and he had actually killed a homosexual, and I think he did some prison time for it. And for some reason, that was a big thing with them. Gay people was a target for them.
That confuses me because back in those times, homosexuality was viewed as a sin, which you would have thought they would have been like, hey, my brothers, like, fellow sinners.
No,
you know?
These guys were like, hey, you know, that's an easy target. I'm going to lure this guy out in the middle of the park and I'm going to stab him 57 times. Gull, this guy that's talking about Satan, he winds up being gay.
That actually explains a lot.
Yes, he winds up being gay.
Yeah.
And there's actually a shirt out. I can't remember what it says. It says something about Satan. Something about Satan and Gull is gay.
Yeah.
And it's got his picture on the front.
Doesn't that harken back to, like, how many times has there been, like, this, like, crazy Republican guy that was just like, we have to keep homosexuals out of schools.
Yeah.
And it turns out they get caught in a hotel with, like, three guys having a gangbang.
Exactly.
So it's just like, yeah.
So
we have to keep people like me away from. Yeah.
Sorry to go off on that tangent.
That's okay. All we do.
I'm so full of, my wife calls it worthless knowledge.
It's not,
when it comes to music and that kind of stuff, you know.
I gotta ask. This question's been burning a hole in my soul. Bakersfield, California, to West Fork, Arkansas.
Yes.
Please explain.
Oh my gosh.
If it's something you want to explain, if you don't, that's fine. We'll skip it.
I mean, there's really not a big story to it. My grandparents, my grandmother grew up in Northwest Arkansas, out of West Fork toward Strickler, past Hawkeye. And so when my grandfather retired, they moved back here, and we moved back here.
How old were you when you came here?
I was just coming out of eighth grade, starting high school.
Wow, okay.
And it's probably a good thing that we moved back here, because I wasn't headed down a very good path.
I gotcha.
You know, my dad was a preacher, but I had found rock and roll.
And you're rebelling like crazy.
Yeah, I shot up heroin when I was in seventh grade.
Dude.
Yeah.
Oh, my
yeah.
God. That's the whole other level of rebellion.
Yeah. So, and you know, I hid that from my parents. But, you know, I was headed down a pretty destructive path. I was already starting to drink a little bit. And I had found Van Halen, which was my first concert in 1978. I was 11 years
Most
old.
Most people thought that was Jesus.
I found Van Halen. Now, let me tell you this story.
Didn't know I was supposed to be looking for him.
here's the cool story. I had a buddy, and his dad was a big stoner. And so I couldn't have Kiss albums in my house. So I finally figured out what I would do is I came up with this code, and I'd go to my buddy's house who had the stereo with the tape deck, and I would tape it, and I had this code to where I knew, okay, this is Dressed to Kill, this is Rock and Roll Over, this is Destroyer. So I had all my tapes and stuff, but I was riding my bike. We lived right at the edge of the oil fields. It was actually Oildale is where we live. Corn is from there.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So if you listen to a lot of Corn music, you can understand what Oildale was like. It was kind of weird and dirty and...
Like super blue collar oil rig workers.
Yeah. So we lived at the edge of the oil fields, and all I did is ride my BMX bike or my motorcycle, or I'd skate or I'd play guitar. And so I'm riding my bike at the edge of the oil fields one day, and there's a cassette tape laying over in the dirt. And I saw it. I thought, oh, I'll go check this out. So I took it home, wiped dust off of it, reeled up the slack that was hanging out of it.
With a pencil, probably.
And Eruption came on. It was Van Halen 1. And it was queued up to Eruption.
I can just see
it's fate.
A beam of light and cassette tape floating down into that.
I started playing when I was 5. I started playing piano. My mom was a concert pianist when she was younger. So she started teaching me, and then she realized that I wasn't paying attention to theory and trying to learn how to read music. I was watching what she was doing, and I was playing it.
Right.
And listening. Well, my dad had a guitar, and so I did the same thing with that. So she thought, okay, let's take classical lessons. So I started taking classical lessons. Well, then I heard Stairway to Heaven.
Oh.
And so I went out and bought the sheet music. My mom bought it thinking it was probably a hymn. You know, she didn't know.
Stairway to Heaven.
She didn't know what Led Zeppelin was.
I love that.
That's amazing.
I buy the sheet music and take it to my teacher, and he's like, yeah, I don't think so. We're not learning that. I was like, but I really want to learn this. So
garbage.
At that point, I had learned enough sight reading, you know, to where I went home and I learned how to play it. About a week later, I go down the street and one of the older kids, he's out in his front yard and he's got this little amp and he's got a cheap Tiesco Del Rey Sears guitar or whatever. It sounded like crap. But to me, it was like hearing the angels sing.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
And so he was like, I said, you mind if I play that? And he said, no, go ahead. And I started playing and he said, well, see if you can play this. And I'm playing this blues riff and I go back to the house and he said, just take it home. I said, cool. So I take it home and I plug it in. He was going to just let me borrow it for a few days. And my Uncle Roger, he came over. Now, my uncle is the one that turned me on to music. He worked at Bakersfield Audio. He had this gigantic stereo system.
He's the cool one,
yes.
Right?
And he had this massive record collection. He would let me come over and listen to whatever I want. And I would choose what to listen to by the album cover.
Oh, yeah, whatever's cool.
Yeah, so yeah. I'm a lot of Uriah Heep, Molly Hatchet.
Oh, for sure. The Big Viking.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. All that kind of stuff.
That looks cool.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I love it.
So I started getting into these bands that weren't on the radio, but he comes over and I play him that riff and he said, that's the intro to Bring It On Home by Led Zeppelin. And I said, huh, okay. He said, let's go to the house. So we load up. He said, Can you play this? Well, then it was probably a week after that, I found that cassette tape. I bring it home and it's queued up to Eruption and I'm just,
oh, forget it, right?
I can't breathe. My chest is pounding. I'm just like, how's he doing that? That can't be a guitar.
Yeah.
How in the world is he doing that? And of course, back then, you know, 1978, you can't YouTube or anything like that. So I'm just freaked out by it. Well, my buddy Bobby Goodman says, hey, you want to spend the night and go to a concert? I said, yeah, that'd be great. That'd be awesome. And so I go spend the night with him. This is like probably a month or two after I find the cassette. And we go to the Bakersfield Civic Auditorium, and it's Van Halen opening for Black Sabbath.
Oh, my God.
And it's just a few weeks into the tour because Sabbath booted Van Halen like 6 weeks after that because they were just kicking their ass every night. So I walk in and sit down, and when we were going in, I see on the marquee Van Halen, and I told him, I said, that's that tape I was telling you about. Well, then I got to see Eddie play Eruption.
Oh, you watched Eddie Van Halen play Eruption.
1978, I was 11 years old.
Jesus Christ.
And I got to see him do that, and so...
And you were cool from that day forward.
Oh, my God.
You had to be.
I went home.
It probably changed everything.
It changed everything.
I went home and I told my mom, I said, I'm done with classical lessons. I got to have an electric guitar and an amp. And so I never got that. So I started hitting these other circles and you know, playing with guys that had extra gear and stuff like that. And then we wound up moving to Arkansas, which is probably good because... With everything that was going on in Hollywood, I would have left school and I'd have been a street rat in Hollywood trying to jump into a band. That would have been the time that Motley Crue was ruling the strip and Rat
playing
was
the Whiskey
coming
a
out with their stuff. You know, Van Halen was just starting to be a huge act at that time, and it's probably a good thing we moved to Arkansas because I don't know if I would have made it. You know, because I have a little bit of an addictive personality sometimes, and I probably would have went down that path, you know, as much as it was around.
Yeah.
So anyway, we wind up in West Fork, Arkansas, and we flew into Tulsa, and we rode in the back of my grandpa's Chevy Big Ten pickup.
Square body. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. With a camper on it. And he had two cots back there for us. And me and my brother and my sister sit in the back of the truck all the way from Tulsa Airport to West Fork or Strickler. And I'm looking around. I'm thinking, well, it kind of looks like some of the places we used to go fish. But, man, I don't see anything fun. So, and of course,
that's an understatement.
We don't go into Fayetteville or anything. We cut through, I think they dropped down 59 out of Siloam, and we went through Lincoln and Prairie Grove and then cut across.
Wow, man.
You know, out to Hawkeye and then Strickland.
Well, there's Battlefield Park, man. Don't knock that. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm freaking. I'm just like, man, I don't know if I can do this. And so get up the next day. I get dressed, grab my skateboard, walk down, bus picks us up, pull up to the school, and there's dirt roads around it. And I looked at my brother and I said, I'm going back. I can't do this. Can't do it. So
can't skate on dirt.
My first day, nobody liked me. The girls liked me because I was the California kid with the blonde hair.
And
I didn't dress anything like I had the OP and the hang ten and the Vans.
And that's why the guys hated you because the girls liked you.
Absolutely. But yeah, I was just so different from everybody. You know, I didn't have an accent. I didn't like to hunt. You know, I didn't know anything about guns. I'd never shot a gun in my life out in California. Well, I take that back. I shot a few with my uncle, you know, when we lived out in California.
But, yeah.
You know, all I wanted to do was skate, freestyle BMX, and be a rock star.
Right.
That was it. And there was none of the above in Arkansas that I saw.
No, especially in West Fork or that area. Yeah, I mean, there were probably, what, 25 kids in your class?
Man, I graduated with 64. When we left California, I had 2,500 in my eighth grade class.
Yeah.
And so it was bizarre.
Yeah.
And I went home that day and I had tears in my eyes. And I told my mom, I said, I'm going back. I'm going to go live with Nana. My other grandma still lived out there. I said, I can live with her. I can go to school. I'll call you. We'll stay in touch, but I don't want anything to do with this place.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to warm up to it? Or did you ever?
It took at least a year.
Really?
At least a year.
Till you got a friend group.
To where I wasn't fighting.
Sure.
Everybody, because nobody liked the new guy.
Right.
You know, and they had their little circles and stuff. And then, you know, fortunately, I was good at baseball and basketball and stuff. So I got in sports and started making some friends.
See, and I felt what's weird is, and you guys probably too, I don't know, but I felt kind of like you, even though I was born and raised here.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it weird how you can take a group of kids that are all born and raised in the exact same place? But by 7th, 8th, 9th grade, this kid thinks he's Vanilla Ice.
Oh, yeah.
This kid is a goat roper.
Mm-hmm.
This kid, which was me, I had... So your experience with Eruption was my... I loved country and old country and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But... And I started getting into rock and roll when I was like 11 or 12. But for me, I think I was like 13 maybe. And if this is going to sound super cliche, everybody says it, but I'm not kidding. When I heard the first licks of Smells Like Teen Spirit, it was like getting kissed by Pam Anderson and eating a cookie and orgasming all at this. It was like it was almost an over sensory overload. I was like, oh, like what is this? You know, like Nirvana was that changed my life.
Yeah.
Like I was like, oh my God, that's when I was like, I'm shredding all my jeans, growing my hair out, wearing flannel, you know, overnight.
I had fun during that period. I had a lot of fun. I played so many different genres of music. You don't know it about, you know, the bands that I played in the past.
Right.
You know, one of my favorite bands I played in was, we're doing alternative stuff in the late 80s, and we were doing like The Alarm, The Cure,
nice.
All the bands. And that probably developed me as a guitar player more than trying to learn all the George Lynch and the Eddie Van Halen and the Steve Vai, that kind of stuff. It was learning to play clean guitar with effect and learning how to use the delay and that kind of stuff, you know?
There's a lot to be said for how much you learn playing with, because I got way better because I was a drummer at first and then playing with guys almost sometimes less is more where you're like sawing away,
right.
But you're like, no, if I ring out here and do this and that.
Absolutely.
What was your first band that you were in?
I had some that we didn't have singers, but I was in a band called Bad Boys, and James Carter started that band.
No way.
And then he left and I came in when he left and started playing, and it was a full-on hair metal band. I had... I'll show you some pictures tonight. I had giant white hair.
Oh, please show me.
I wore the spandex. We would go to the mall to a woman's shoe store called Baker's and buy white boots You know, love it. What do you mean you don't have that to size 17?
Yeah. I'm in a band, man. Come on.
All of us are wearing these boots and our toes are tucked back in them because we can't get them big enough. But by God, we're going to wear white boots.
I love that.
You know.
So but, what did you guys think about the Nirvana then? The hair metal people? I mean, were you into it?
I had quit playing in Bad Boys and I started playing in this band called Slant Tammy.
Okay.
And that's the band that we were doing the alternative stuff.
So you were kind of already there.
I was. I actually had a friend that lived out in LA and she was sending me Pearl Jam and all that stuff before it hit radio back here. So when I was in Slant Tammy, we were playing Even Flow and Alive.
Oh, that's cool.
And Man in the Box.
Damn,
and that kind of stuff, and none of it had been on the radio back here.
So it sounded like originals here.
Everyone's like, that is the best goddamn band ever.
You know, it was right around the time that it was really breaking on MTV. You know, it was sure. MTV was making that transition from hair metal, and you know, the whole hair metal thing it was all copycat bands at that point. Everybody sounded the same. I don't remember who it was said, it was Slash. In his book, he said, when the W bands came in, that's when we knew it was over with. And he was talking about Warrant, Winger, Whitesnake. all those bands.
Oh, so they were second wave hair metal?
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
That was
and
what
then,
you're saying?
So all
I guess
the,
I never really thought about that.
All the bands either. Sound the same. And go watch Decline of the Western Civilization, The Metal Years. It delves into the Sunset Strip at the ass end of it, and it shows you all these people. Rat was gone. They were big. Poison was gone. They were big. Guns. All
Cinderella,
those guys.
Probably like.
So you had this one band called London that Nikki Sixx actually played in before he was in Motley Crue.
Really?
And they wore out the Sunset Strip for 10 years and never got signed. And so it shows you all these bands that are coming up. And they're horrible. They're absolutely horrible. And unfortunately for them, it was after the big signing frenzy. You know, once Rat started getting big and Motley started getting big, all the labels wanted their hair metal band.
They're looking for the closest.
So, man, they're snatching freaking bands up left and right. Well, they didn't care that those bands sucked.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there was some horrible music that came out of that time period. So by the time grunge hit, I loved it.
Yeah.
I freaking absolutely loved
it. Awesome.
But, you know, at that point, I was playing alternative music anyway. We were doing all the Alarm, U2, that kind of stuff. But then we were also doing The Cult and King's X.
Oh, cool.
And that kind of stuff, you know. So I was primed for that stuff. And when it came out, I wasn't a huge Nirvana fan. I thought Smells Like Teen Spirit was a cool song when it first came out.
Yeah.
And I loved the video. But I never really turned into a Nirvana fan. I leaned more toward Soundgarden and Alice.
That was mine too.
Yeah, I leaned toward the heavy. So I've always been, you know, every band I play in, I'm always the heavy guy. You know, even now, you know, in 90 Pound Wrench, I'm the guy that listens to freaking Lamb of God and Pantera and all that stuff, you know. But going from hair metal to alternative to grunge was a really, really cool way to transition as a guitar player.
Right.
Because I was trying to learn how to shred. It was all about flash. Who cares about the song? I'm going to tap. I'm going to dive bomb. I'm doing all this crap. My hair's going to be big.
Yeah.
Then
shredding went out the window.
Yes.
Then.
Oh, yeah.
No one gave a shit.
For the longest time, music didn't have guitar solos.
No. Yeah.
You know,
and a lot of those bands were three piece, which I remember my friend saying, there's only three in that band. It's like, wait, there's got to be a lead guitarist and a rhythm guitar. I mean, how's that going to work? And then you listen, you're like, okay, there's verses where it just has bass and drums and it's cool. Like, you know,
I loved it.
Yeah.
See, I'm a sucker. My favorite thing about cool songs and the songs that suck me in are the ones that have big holes in them.
Yeah.
You know, that aren't busy.
Yeah.
Let's
sure.
go from this badass riff all of a sudden, let's shrink it down.
Yeah. Where it all go. Yeah.
I love that stuff. Yeah. Absolutely love it. And I had also, even back when I was playing hair metal and before, I was into punk rock.
Oh.
So I loved the Pistols, you know, and I loved the New York Dolls. I loved Iggy. I loved all that stuff.
Did you ever listen to Bad Brains?
I did.
Oh, dude.
Then, God. Well, that's not really second. Well, yeah, I'd call it second wave. You know, they came in after the Pistols and stuff, but you had Bad Brains, and my favorite was Minor Threat.
Oh, yeah. I listened to them.
Freaking loved Minor Threat. And then they turned into Fugazi, you know.
Okay,
yeah. And so I was really into that kind of stuff anyway. So when the grunge thing hit, it had that minimalistic thing of the punk scene because those guys listen to punk.
Yeah.
I mean, you, Jeff Ament, the bass player from Pearl Jam, huge punk fan.
Yeah,
you
Kurt know? Cobain was a big punk fan as well. Yeah,
absolutely. And you can tell by the music that came out then. And what I find fascinating is it's funny the way the area that the music comes from, you can actually see why it does. You know, the hair metal and the whole Sunset Strip thing went hand in hand. It was perfect.
Right.
You know, everything that was seedy.
Sunshine, excess, big tan titties, cocaine. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, go up to Seattle and see how much sunshine you get.
There you go, man.
You get shitty weather all the time. It's doom and gloom.
And that gave you hunger strike.
it gave you a lot of stuff.
I remember somebody at one time complaining about Seattle rock, and they were saying that a lot of the kids that came out with these songs were from wealthy households and how they're singing about having all these, you know, inner demons and angst, and how can they have that being from those rich households? But I just think that totally misses the point, because the perfect house and the $300,000 house or $400,000, whatever it was then, that doesn't mean that everything's rosy.
No, if you're a teenager, you're going to have angst.
Well, look at Layne Staley.
Yeah.
His family was loaded.
Yeah.
You know, and he in the interviews, he said, I was a Bellevue brat.
Yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
He came from money and turned into the Layne Staley that we know.
Sounds like Towns Van Zandt. He walked away from a rich family, too. And anyway, that's not a very different genre. But
I just think there's probably just some deeply secretive issues that makes you, and not in all cases, but, you know, you can't just say they have it made. They shouldn't. They don't have anything to sing about.
Like, well, they all have their stories. You
that's
know?
Right. That's
Cobain talked about living under a bridge.
And
depending on which interview, you know, was he molested by a family member? That kind of stuff. Did he have homosexual tendencies? You know, because he talked about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, kids at that age, you know, when you were growing up, you had all kinds of shit swirling around in your head.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you get stuff like that. And once again, I think the environment. You know, if you're in a place, you're in a negative mood anyway, and it rains all the freaking time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The suicide rate there is through the roof, yeah.
Oh, and heroin addiction.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that was the heroin capital of the world then.
Yeah. Man, like, no matter where you are, like you said, you're just a teenager, and you're trying to figure out who you are and all these hormones, you're going to have angst.
Yeah.
Dude, all the songs... It's embarrassing as hell, and I'm embarrassed that I've recorded several of these because I had a little recorder. I started writing and recording songs at like 14, and up until I was like in my early 20s, it was all slow, just bullshit. It's the most embarrassing.
You were like Adam Sandler on The Wedding Singer. I was listening. You'll have to bear with me. I was listening to you a lot of The Cure at this time.
Kill me, please, pretty please. Yeah. Most of mine was like, I like this girl and she doesn't know I'm alive. Yeah. And so it was horrible. So yeah, man, you don't have to be like, you don't have to come from, you know, a horrible dark background to have all those feelings.
Yeah, sure. Because it wasn't bullshit to you. I mean, if someone's feeling something, it's real, whether you think that they should feel that or not. I mean, So there you go.
Well, in like I said, the things that happen to these people, Eddie Vedder, for one thing, when Pearl Jam, when Andrew Wood died, you know about Mother Love Bone.
Yeah.
You know, they had just recorded their debut album for a major label, and they were slated to be the next huge band. And I loved them. I thought they were great songs. And Andy Wood was just the quintessential
rock star, man. Yeah.
You know, Stone Gossard, as Chris Cornell was talking about him, because Andy and Chris lived together. And Chris Cornell said, the cool thing about Andrew Wood was you'd go to a show and there'd be 15 people and he'd be up there saying, your mother wears combat boots, getting these big, he's like, he's playing Madison Square Garden.
Yeah.
You know, every freaking show, it was so big.
Isn't that, didn't Chris Cornell write Say Hello to Heaven about Andrew Wood?
That whole album is okay. about Andrew Wood.
Okay.
Because
okay.
they were roommates.
Right.
They were
right.
roommates. They actually, when they were home together, they would have a contest every night to see who could write a song faster than the other guy.
Oh, my God.
And so Andrew Wood would go in there and pound this stuff out on his keyboard, and Chris Cornell's in there, you know, writing away on the guitar.
And Andy Wood was drug overdose?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, he had a heroin overdose.
Okay.
So when that happened, of course, Mother Love Bone was done. Mm-hmm. And so the whole Pearl Jam thing was percolating, and mm-hmm. they were looking for a singer. That somebody told them about this surfer guy in San Diego, which was Eddie Vedder. So they sent a tape to him, and he sent it back, and they were just blown away. I love Eddie Vedder's voice.
Wait, they sent a tape for him to dub, like, his vocals?
They wanted, yeah. They sent the music all the way to San Diego.
That's awesome.
And they said that they got it back in, like, a week and a half, something like that. And they were listening to it, and they were just blown away by the lyrics and stuff, but also, you know, the inflection in his voice.
Sure.
He's it's a very emotional
I wonder how.
Singer.
Yeah.
I wonder how that works. I wonder how he even knows, like, what they're thinking, how he should sing to it, or the melody or whatever. Maybe they talk on the phone about it.
I don't know, man.
Yeah, you there's got to be a story there, obviously.
It may have just been the perfect storm.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
because
it seems very awesome.
He was actually going through, he had just found out that the guy he thought was his dad was not his real dad.
Oh, wow.
And the guy that was his real dad, he saw every once in a while, and they called him Uncle so-and-so.
Whoa.
So he had just found that out, and it was really, really messing with him.
Yeah.
And so it was their first practice. Eddie Vedder flew to Seattle and got off the plane, and he told Jeff Ament, I don't want to go to the hotel. I don't want to do anything. Let's just go to the practice room. And so they go in there, and they play, I can't remember which song it was. It was Alive, I think.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was Release Me.
Okay.
Release. I can't remember. But anyway, at the end of the song, Eddie just runs out of the room. So they go out there to find him. He's just sobbing in the hallway because he was so moved by everything.
Sure.
You know?
It's exactly what he needed, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah.
As an outlet for his emotions and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so you couple that with the whole teen angst thing.
Yeah.
And the gloomy weather and the heroin situation and everything else that's going on in Seattle. And that's what shaped that whole sound. You know?
As far as that part goes, I got a question for all you guys, because you guys have played way more music than I have. But let's say you're auditioning someone. Don't you almost immediately know if it's going to work? Like, within seconds, almost. Like, especially if it's a drummer. Because Joe and I played with a bunch of different drummers. But I don't know. I'll let you guys kind of talk about that, because it seems like when Joe and I played, it's like, oh yeah, that's going to work.
Yeah. Because especially if it's a drummer, it's a feel thing.
Sure.
And yeah. You can tell when a guy comes in and he's playing on top of the beat, everything feels twice as fast as it should be.
Yeah.
And it's not, you're playing at the right tempo.
Oh yeah.
But everything's on top.
Saying.
So you feel like everything's hauling ass.
Yeah.
So then you got to say, well, okay, yeah. Back it off, Tonto.
But if you have to say you know, that, but if you have to say that, that's, you know, it's probably not.
Well, our drummer now, Jeremiah, he's one of the best drummers that we've had in this band. I mean, that kid is just amazing. But when he came into his first audition, he had texted me the night before, and he said, I'm ready. I got everything learned. Let's go. He came in. He didn't know all the songs.
Really? Mm.
And so we stopped, and we were like, dude, you had 2 weeks to learn these songs. What's up? And he didn't have any answers. And so our first thought was,
see ya.
Man, I don't know if this guy's going to work or not.
Right.
He's got chops, and it feels good when we're playing with him, but, you know, is he going to be able to do the job? And thank God we gave him a second chance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, I mean, the first thing that gets me when adding a member to a band is I immediately know if I'm going to be able to gel with them as a person.
Yeah, which is almost more important.
It's way more important.
Yeah.
You know, I'll take a guy that I get along with that's a good guitar player and let a dickhead that's a shredder walk on down the road.
That's how me and this beautiful bastard right here met 20 years ago.
That's awesome.
I had a band. I'd started a band, and my Jesse, our guitar player, who was a brilliant this guy, really my band is the only band he was ever in. He was responsible for writing half the songs with the music. Mm-hmm. Brilliant. Just, he would write stuff. My brain would just never think of that.
Yeah.
Just really cool. Like the meat and potatoes of the song, just like a couple riffs and then Joe would build on it.
But, yeah. And we would just play back and forth. Yeah. We wrote so many songs together like that. And we needed a bass player. And so our drummer was like, I know this guy over in Lincoln, you know, it's like, okay, have him come over. And then that's, you know, Ivan walked up with his bass and that was in like 2001 or
that's
something.
Awesome.
Yeah. So that's how I met him. And that's it was the awesome. Same thing. I automatically gelled with him as a person. And then as soon as we started playing, he, you know, I was like, oh, he's badass on bass too. Like, this is great, you know. So.
But you guys were playing the stuff I'd listened to for so long. So that style of stuff. So it worked out perfectly.
It's funny how that stuff works.
Yeah.
One of the people that I write best with, I played in a band in the 90s when we did the whole grunge thing, but we were doing original stuff too. I'll play you some of that because it's like, if Slayer was trying to be a grunge band, that's what it was like. I mean, we could not shuck our metal roots at all, but we were doing all the cover tunes and stuff. But anyway, Craig played in a rival band back in the 80s. He was in a band called Defiance, and they actually moved out to California and tried to do the whole Hollywood thing, and they all got strung out on coke and wound up, you know, coming home with their, I hate to say their tail, but between their legs, but you know, they found out what it was like.
Right.
So anyway, Craig and I got to be good friends. And I think in the beginning it was because I was dating the girl that he was in love with. So I think he was trying to keep me on a short leash and he actually started running sound for the alternative band that I was in. Well, when we broke up, I told him, I said, man, I got to put something together and let's see what happens. Cause he's a guitar player too. So I brought my stack over to his house and we sat down and he said, well, I've got this riff. And 15 minutes later, we had a song.
Oh, I love it when that
And happens. It was a good song.
Yeah.
And I mean, an intricate, really cool song. And I was like, okay, so what do you got after that? And he played me another riff. And I always was able to hear something to play over the top of what he was playing. You know, it's just like musical soulmates, I guess.
It is. Know? Music is like a language bizarre. That transcends all like age, you know, nationality, language.
Yeah.
It's so cool. Yeah. Like, I don't know if you guys, I'm sure you have at one point or another, ever have a jam night where there's just kind of random people there, but if it's something everyone knows, you've never seen that guy before, but you can just get all together and just play this, you know, it's so cool.
I love it. I love it. That's awesome. We had kind of like that, but we weren't really jamming. I got off work late, and I was out of bands at this point. I had, through the 90s, developed my own little cocaine habit, you know, and being on the road with a couple of bands and stuff. So I met my wife, got married, quit playing music, started working for the phone company, but I had an acoustic, and I would still go over to Craig's house. And so one night I got off at like 10 o'clock, and I grabbed beer and went over and surprised him. Well, this one dude was there, and I didn't know the guy could sing. And I mean, he could really freaking sing. And Craig had this acoustic thing that he had come up with. He said, well, grab a guitar and let's see what you can do with this. And we made one pass at it and we got done and everybody just, nobody could say anything. I mean, it was just spot on first try. And we did that with two songs that night. So
that's crazy. Yeah. And Joe was talking about the jam night. Isn't it crazy? Like, you're playing not even a cover. It's just somebody's doing a riff that, you know, everyone starts going. And then the drummer like does a fill into a transition and the guitarist hits a note that you hear that you like, and you're on bass and you hit that same note. Like you didn't talk about anything and it's not a traditional like blues riff that would go to, it's crazy. It's magic. I don't know what it is.
That's the cool freaking thing about music, man. Those little moments and, you know, your influences that you don't realize you have. And I wear my influences on my sleeve, you know, our original stuff. You'll hear George Lynch, you'll hear Lamb of God, you know, you'll hear all the stuff that I'm into. And it's cool to have the other influences that, you know, people wear on their sleeve and see how they intertwine. We found that out when we did our CD. We had some songs that we had written. Me and James and Chuck were in a band called Wishpool previous to 90 Pound Wrench. And we had written 4 songs, I think. And so we kind of rehashed those and heavied them up a little bit. And then the rest of the stuff that we did on the CD, 14 songs, we wrote in the studio.
Really?
And this was when modeling processors were first starting to come out, and I had the first Line 6 pedal board.
Oh, I remember those.
XT Live.
Those were the shit.
And so we walk in there with our stacks and can't get a good tone. And I said, man, we're just demoing stuff. We're laying down scratch tracks anyway for drums and bass. So we plugged that dude in, and Chuck had a Behringer V amp, I think, in the rack. So we're using these modeling processors, and all of a sudden, man, that sounds pretty freaking good. And so James and I would sit side by side on this couch, and we'd just bang riffs off each other. James would go out to piss, and he'd come in. I'd say, what do you think of this? Vice versa. And we just bounced stuff off each other and wrote in the studio, which I'd never really done before, especially in that situation. I would always come in with a full song.
Right.
And then we'd change a few parts here and there.
Yeah, that has to be kind of stressful to say you're going to, you're going to come up with it there.
Because mm-hmm.
you're thinking, well, what if we don't, But you kind of trust the power of, each other, right?
We wrote 10 songs in the studio.
That's crazy.
Yeah. That's wild, because I was always like, and maybe this is more common, it like hits you. Like, back when I worked with other guys, they would laugh at me because we'd be driving down the road in the work truck and a line would just hit.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd be like, I'd pull over. I'd be like, where's a pen? Where's a goddamn pen? And I'd find a piece of paper and jot it down, even if it was just 2 sentences.
Oh, yeah.
It was like, I'll just save that for, we'll build off that later. But yeah, doing it in studio. It's
crazy, crazy how that stuff works.
Yeah.
Man.
And like Neil Young, we said this before, but Neil Young one time said, it's all, when everything's firing on all cylinders, it's almost like you remember a song. Like it's coming to you almost as fast as you can write it.
Absolutely.
It's just like it was there.
Absolutely.
So cool.
Absolutely. I love that. I love every bit of the creative process. Like
that's me too.
When we were in the studio, James, he's real meticulous about his playing.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wants to write his solos before he comes in there. He wants to have everything worked out. So when it's his time, roll the tape and he's good to go. I'm not like that. I can't sit down and write a solo. So the way I worked was, I would go in by myself and I'd tell Chuck would make a loop of the rhythm that I was going to play through. And I'd get up there and just start wailing, and we would stop it. And he would say, okay, I really like that. I didn't like this so much, but I like this. Can you tie them together?
Yeah.
And then I would piece the solos together,
That's awesome.
On the spot.
Yeah.
And man, I love that stuff.
Sure. Yeah. That sounds amazing.
I just absolutely love it.
Wow.
And that's what, and so, we've played for live audiences a million times. If I had the choice, I've always been like this though. I way more prefer the creative, just the writing and recording.
I love the studio.
That's my favorite.
Yes.
I like playing. I love playing live at times. I like it when the crowd likes it,
mm-hmm.
Too, cause we've played so many casinos and stuff, but God, those nights when you're just like an oil painting and no one's paying attention and you just look out across there and no one's looking and it's just people smoking and hitting the machines. And sometimes it's just utterly depressing where you're just like, no one's even listening. What the hell are we doing? But thankfully there haven't been a whole lot of nights like that, but the worst one ever, you ever heard of Uglies, the bar over by Grand Lake?
No,
I think it was called Uglies.
Appropriate name, probably.
Well, when we were there. But anyway, we went and played there one night, and it was just not our crowd because they wanted country. We're classic rock. And it was just like, it looked like a lot of trust fund kids that were coming in off these big, nice boats and coming in there. And I remember during one break, a guy came up to me. He just had douche all over him. And he was like, listen, man, when you get back up
That's not good.
No, literally.
Yeah.
He's like, when you get back up there, I want to hear some Jason Aldean. I want to hear some Brantley Gilbert. And I'm like, we'll see if we can get around to that,
Yeah.
I don't have a quarter slot anywhere. I'm not a jukebox.
So the last hour of that show, we were playing to just the waitresses sweeping the floor and turning the chairs upside down. And there was literally not one customer in the entire place. But we had to play till midnight or whatever, so we finished. But, like, God, talk about it depressing.
Oh, dude.
Drive home.
I've had so many of those situations. What's this place right outside Siloam? It was like the Double Deuce for a while.
Yeah, Tipsies.
Okay.
Then it was Red.
Red Dirt.
Dirt. Yes. Yeah.
So back in the late 80s, that place was called Nighttown.
Nighttown. Really? God, that's been a place like that forever.
Yeah. So I was in Bad Boys and we're starting a book and somebody had bought cocaine from the guy that owned it or something like that.
It was the 80s.
Yeah. And the guy's like, hey, why don't you come out and play? So we go out there to play. Well, the first night it went over well, you know, and we're all spandexed out and everything.
I love that visual.
I'm nervous anyway because it's out in the country outside of Siloam Springs, and I'm thinking, man, this just isn't going to happen. But we went out there, had a good time, so they booked us again. Second time we go out there, it's not so good because we set everything up and then go get something to eat, and we come back, and there's nothing but a bunch of cowboy hats in there.
Oh, no.
And I'm thinking, damn it. These guys aren't going to know poison. And
I can't two-step to Unskinny Bop Bop.
Well, we took off, and that's what they said. We hear somebody say, I need a two-stepping song.
Yeah.
And our singer's like, man, sorry. You know, we're not that kind of band. You know, if you just give us a chance, we'll get you dancing. And we launch into the next song, and I hear something hit right behind me.
Oh, shit.
I thought, son of a bitch. And so I look around, and it's a salt shaker. So these guys are picking up salt shakers, and luckily it wasn't bottles. They're throwing ashtrays and stuff at us.
Oh, my God.
So we finished the song.
Ashtray's pretty damn heavy.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. So we finished the song that we're playing, probably freaking Talk Dirty to Me or some crap like that they had no clue was out there. And I just look at the guys, and I said, just follow me. And luckily I knew Folsom Prison Blues.
You're kidding me.
So I hit the clean channel and I take off. Luckily, the singer knew the words. The bass player knew how to play country bass, which I never knew. And we limped our way through Folsom Prison Blues.
In full spandex and big hair.
In full spandex and huge hair.
I love it.
And got a standing ovation. And then the rest of the night was okay.
That's awesome.
Actually, I think we played Folsom Prison Blues again later on in the night.
You just played it over and over.
Yeah.
You know what you could have done? You could have played Hot for Teacher, but you could have changed it to Sister, and that probably would have. That probably might have gone over. I don't know.
Well, a few weeks after our last show there, the singer and the bass player went out there to hang out and probably buy cocaine from the owner.
Okay.
Because, I mean, that was part of the gig there. You know, it's like you get the buffet at the casino. You went in the office.
You get three lines
You went in the office.
It's kind of a buffet. It's in lines.
I'm going to pay you $100 and.
I gotcha.
One of those kind of things.
Yeah.
It's a comp.
So they went back out there and got the living shit kicked out of them.
No way.
As soon as they walked in the door, somebody said something. And, I mean, the singer almost got his ear ripped off. It was bad.
Were they like dressed? Were they sticking out, standing out?
Yeah. We used to call it... Before I started playing with them, we would go to the rink, and they would walk in, and somebody would say, oh, there's the Q-tip twins, because they had this giant white hair.
Oh, dude.
You know? But I always thought, man, those guys are freaking rock stars. Look at them walking in here in spandex and freaking conchos on their belt and all that kind of stuff. You know,
wow.
Little did I know, I'd play in a band with them, and then they'd get their ass kicked in West Siloam Springs, Arkansas, in a goddamn redneck bar that we were playing in spandex.
I can't believe you guys played there. That's so crazy to me.
Oh, man.
Quiet your mind.
Hey, so I have this little thing I want to do, if you guys don't mind, for a second.
Knock yourself out.
This spurred from a conversation that we had maybe yesterday. Or the day before. What do you think, Scott, the song Cinnamon Girl by Neil Young?
Ooh.
What do you think is the subject? Who do you think the Cinnamon Girl was? Just a question. I mean, I know what these guys think.
Man, I have no clue.
Okay.
I mean, see, I don't know that much about Neil Young, so I don't know what his circle was like back then, except for when he was down recording at Sound City.
Okay.
And I know that from the Sound City.
Well, Cinnamon Girl does come from, it doesn't come up from Canada. It was written from like California.
I could see it being about the chick that ran the front desk at Sound City.
No.
Paula.
Oh, yeah.
Can't remember her name. Everybody that went in Sound City thought that she was in love with them. Wow. And she was an Italian girl. But I can't remember her last name.
Yeah, I remember.
So I could see that. And then my next guess would be a groupie somewhere that's always at every show.
Well, I don't even know. Ever since I've been a kid, Ivan just blew my mind the other day. Ever since I was a little kid, no reason why, but I just assumed that it was about a black girl. I don't even know why. It was just one of those things where the first time I heard it, I was like, oh, Neil Young likes black girls. Cool, I do too. They're gorgeous, right?
Yeah.
I was just like, oh. And then for the next 30 years of my life, I just thought. And so I'd mentioned something like that to Ivan and Sam in our little text group. And I think Ivan was the one that said, oh, I thought that meant like it was like for a redheaded girl.
Ooh,
and that's what I always thought.
That hit me like a ton of
bugs.
I think Sam said that too, didn't you?
Maybe you both did.
Yeah. I don't know if how that worked out.
But I was like, that makes
interesting
a lot more sense.
Absolutely.
Well, I'd read that the founding member of Los Lobos said, no, I thought it was about a Mexican girl, you know? So I wasn't the only one that associated it with.
There's no telling.
So
have you ever Googled it?
I have some notes.
Oh, excellent.
This is our researcher.
I have some notes. Okay.
Notes.
Can I take a guess?
Yes.
Off of what I just Googled. If it's in,
that's not fair. You're over there Googling it.
Can I take a Google guess?
What do I do during the podcast?
Okay, go ahead. You're probably gonna piss all over my research.
I'll edit it out.
Okay,
Joe, he's a producer. Don't mess with the producer.
Just tell me what did you find when you Googled it?
Is it a reference to heroin?
Oh no, I didn't find that.
That's what this says. It says in the 60s, cinnamon was a reference to heroin.
Wow. Whoa.
So maybe you a girl with heroin?
I started to say. It could be a drug reference.
Oh. Okay. Well, I'll tell you this.
All of my life with the cinnamon.
There's a lot of people in this forum that says Cinnamon Girl is an obvious heroin reference.
Huh.
A slang term in the 60s for heroin was cinnamon.
Hmm.
Wow, that's a new angle.
Yeah, I didn't see that at all. And that's weird. That's the first thing. Is it our algorithms different? Do you look up a lot of drug stuff, Sam? I researched this for like an hour.
Yours probably had Ted Bundy references. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, look. First off, I didn't know this. Neil Young wrote Cinnamon Girl, Cowgirl in the Sand, and Down by the River all in one afternoon.
Wow. That's amazing.
He had the flu. He had 103 degree fever and he was delirious. And he wrote all those three songs in like 4 hours.
That's interesting.
That's the first thing I found that was cool.
Yeah, because Down by the River is three chords and it's 7 minutes long. It really
makes sense.
I think it's just three chords.
You're probably right.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm not knocking it. It's one of my favorite songs, but yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so Neil Young has never said who or what the Cinnamon Girl was, but he did release a box album called Decade years back.
I remember that.
In the liner notes, he wrote a little note about each song. About Cinnamon Girl, he wrote, quote, wrote this for a seedy girl on peeling pavement, coming at me through Phil Ox eyes, playing finger cymbals. It was hard to explain to my wife. So this is the sentence that for years, everybody's been like, what does it mean?
Cryptic.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I tried to dissect it.
Yeah, there you go.
Phil Ox was a singer-songwriter and a 60s protest singer guy who declined pretty quickly into alcoholism and mental issues. Sorry. Committed suicide by hanging in 1976 when he was just 35. So he was around the same scene at the same time in California as Neil.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the finger cymbals thing, that, from what I could tell, maybe referred to a folk singer named Jean Ray. She played finger cymbals and would sing on stage with this other guy, Jim, that would play guitar. Funny thing is, I looked more into the Phil Ox thing. That tied to Jean Ray as well because she played, one of her most prominent performances was at Phil Ox's memorial when he passed away. So she was really close. Her, Neil, and Phil were all three kind of around the Topanga, California area at the same time in the 60s. So my guess is that it's this Gene, who also, by the way, Jean Ray has fiery, fiery red hair, right?
Interesting.
Also, there's,
nailed it.
I found another one that a lot of people think it was Jim Morrison's common law wife, Pamela Corson. who I guess was close with Neil Young. She had super red hair as well.
That's the chick he locked in the closet.
And I believe so.
Caught on fire?
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't even know that story.
Yeah, that cinnamon girl caught on fire. Yeah. So, anyway, that's
interesting.
Yeah, I just yeah. it just Very blew cool. my mind. And yeah. Looking back, I was like, I don't even know why I thought it was about he was singing about a black girl. I don't even know why
that's
thought
very
that.
Very cool. This is awesome.
Hey, man, I knew it was going to be great.
Yeah, this is awesome.
We didn't even touch on a lot of stuff I wanted to get to with you. So, yeah man, I can't wait to have you back.
Yeah, I would love to.
So, if you ever get bored, we have a new thing now, and this is for anyone. It's 417. Is it 417?
Yes.
I can't remember now. 417-4-MANTIS. That's our Dawn of Mantis voicemail. Leave anything you want on that.
Wow.
417, the number 4, and then spell out
that's
Mantis.
That's right. Just call it and leave us voicemails. It doesn't ring anyone's phone. It just kind of lives there. And then if it's something awesome, we'll play it and riff on it.
Man, even if you're just driving.
You guys screwed the pooch. Give me that number. Game on.
Do it.
Hey, you know, I listened to Chris Jericho's podcast, and every Friday he gets a voicemail from Duff McKagan that's a joke of the day.
That's
no
awesome.
Way.
That's
awesome.
Cool.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, you can do that to us.
I'll do it.
But guys, listen, if you want to do a funny impression, or if you just think of something, or if you're just like want to call and it beeps and you just go like, why do you drive on a parkway and park in a driveway, or just whatever you think, or if you want to fart into the phone, I don't care, do something funny.
Or if you've been kidnapped and make your way to a telephone and you got to call somebody, call that number and we will do what we can to help you.
You get arrested, you get one call, that's the call.
Yeah, that's
like
it.
Did you call a lawyer? No, I called the Donna Mantis hotline. What? It's like, how's
if
that gonna
you
help
see
you?
A UFO,
yeah, that's right,
or a ghost.
Nice.
Yes, report
there you
yeah
go.
Bad impressions, we already said that. It just anything goes.
Anything goes.
We won't be offended.
Maybe, well, you're being a pretty gentle. There's some weird people out there.
I don't know. I don't think I'll be offended. We're asking for it. But it's no one's real number. It's like a Google Voice thing, so don't worry about that.
Well, Scott, you're a gentleman, a scholar, a hell of a guitar player, just a great dude. Seriously, the nicest guy. We talked yeah about, when we were talking about having you on, Not Brown Nose, and I swear to God, all three of us were like, I think that's genuinely the sweetest guy we know.
Yeah.
So that's
man,
the truth,
I appreciate
dude
that.
So I'm really glad that you came in and talked
hey
to
my
us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Good night, folks.
Let me tell you about some fellas I know named Ivan, Sam, and Joe. They got themselves a little podcast, you know. They talk about everything under the sun that they find interesting, spooky, or fun. And they sure ain't trying to impress no one. The remedy to too much time on your hands is take a little listen to the Dawn of Mantis. They talk about killers, monsters, and cults. French mates from hell, disappeared folks. Occasionally throw in a few dad jokes. They try to make every story extra nice by adding their own ginger spice. Not one time or two, but thrice. Right. The remedy to too much time on your hands is take a little listen to the Dawn of Mantis. I'm sure these fellas will be around for quite a spell, 'cause there sure ain't no shortage of stories to tell, 'cause this old world's as weird as hell. But hell, even if nobody listened, you know they'd maintain a fine disposition, 'cause shooting the breeze is kind of their mission. The remedy to too much time on your end.